Good morning.
It's definitely too early and almost certainly ill-advised, but hey, it's also almost Christmas.
The other way, the way Eskimos have 30 words for snow.
Yes.
Well, we have more than 30 for being drunk. Must be so let me give you a few of them.
Thank you. See,
loaded, twisted, full, scuttered, stoshes, belubas, locked, langered, mouldy, polluted, fluted, plastered, ossified, gee-eyed, demented, buckled, wasted, paralytic, legless, hammered, banjoed, mangled, piss-trollied, sloshed.
Not that we'd be advising it. That was Pádraig Branach giving Terry Dolan an education in the language of the tipsy on Bowman on Sunday to mark the publication of the fourth edition of his Dictionary of Hiberno-English. But you might need a little snifter to soften the blow for what follows, because yesterday, as restrictions were eased to allow inter-county travel and household visits, Northern Ireland announced a tough six-week lockdown, including curfews, and ding-dong merrily on high, warning bells from NPHET here as to dangerously rising COVID numbers and calls to close the hospitality sector before the new year. Two words, bah and humbug. Here's Tony Houlihan with Áine on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
I don't know whether you heard Mark McGowan, the president of the Restaurants Association, earlier in the programme. Of course, it's the last kind of news he wants to hear, because it looks as if hospitality is what's going to be getting the big hit after Christmas if non-essential retail is allowed to stay open. He said they can't cope with this yo-yo jumping in and out of severe restrictions. And he said there are zero cases linked to restaurants in the latest HSPC report. It's coming from households in your own data. So why are they being picked on?
So nobody's been picked on. We've made our recommendations based on the COVID, living with COVID plan, setting out the measures that we believe now need to be taken, but government has to make those decisions, as I've said. We've done it on the basis of the analysis of the data that we have available to us. We think the level of social contact that's now happening has increased. We have the data that shows that over the last week in particular, we have significantly increased to a level we cannot cope with as a country, our social contacts. We have to reduce those social contacts.
But is that where people are picking up the disease?
In as much as possible. What's really important is that in all the opportunities for people to have social contact, we need to reduce those opportunities for social contact. And if we could do that, every time people come together, irrespective of the setting, but particularly when that setting is an indoor setting, particularly where things like ventilation is poor, particularly where we have use of alcohol, and as you know, if we're honest, we have a challenge in this country. It is really difficult for us all to maintain adherence to public health advice when it's mixed in, as it were, with use of alcohol. But all of those kinds of factors come together to create risks that this virus loves, if you like. The virus loves indoor settings, it loves close contact between people, and it loves alcohol. And if we give it the opportunity, it will transmit very, very quickly. And that's what we're seeing.
And the decision on this now rests with government. So Christmas, ho, ho and ho. New Year, old anxiety? Maybe not so much. However, if that was less than glad tidings, we did have some rather good news on the COVID front on Tuesday.
Some news just in the last few minutes. It's been reported that the EU Medicines Agency is to meet on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine on December the 21st, which is slightly earlier than thought. And there are some reports coming in from Germany that Germany expects to be able to approve use of the vaccine there by December the 23rd. So some good news there on the vaccine front.
So it's happening very quickly, with a lot of optimism that, subject to approval, we'll start a coordinated EU vaccination programme as early as December 27th. And Ireland has secured an advance purchase of 2.3 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. First up, the over 65s in long-term care settings and frontline healthcare workers, and then onwards it will roll. Here's Health Minister Stephen Donnelly on Wednesday's Morning Ireland with Samantha Labrerie.
As the plan progresses, those with underlying conditions will also be higher up the priority list. How do you establish who has an underlying condition? Does that come from the GPs? Is it something that somebody self-declares? Is there a database there that says these people have these conditions and therefore they should go next?
Well, this will be clinically led. So in the first instance, the
The recommendation we got from NIAC, that's our expert group, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee, and then ratified by NPHET, what they said is in the first instance, it's men and women over 65 in long-term residential care settings, including nursing homes. Why? Because they are most at risk. And remember, tragically, in the first wave, over half of the people who died were in these settings. After that, then, it's the frontline healthcare workers in direct patient contact. And then we move down through ages and, as you say, people with underlying conditions. Exactly how that will be done, it depends on a variety of things. It depends on technical information that our expert group are looking for from the European Medicines Agency as part of their validation process. It depends on the vaccines themselves. So, for example, the Pfizer vaccine has to be stored at an ultra-low temperature, at minus 70 degrees Celsius. It's not the kind of thing that a GP surgery or pharmacy could have. But the EMA are looking then at a second vaccine called Moderna on the 12th of January, and that, my understanding is, could be stored at a normal refrigerated temperature, which would allow distribution through pharmacies, through GPs and so forth.
Okay,
so really, what our experts are saying is we need to wait to see which vaccines are authorised, and then the technical information coming from the regulator as to exactly what the appropriate way to distribute that is.
And later, Claire spoke to head of the vaccination task force, Professor Breen McCrae, who gave a handy visual description of how it all might work.
It's worth talking through what this looks like, Claire. The Pfizer vaccines come in packs. The basic pack looks like a 10-inch pizza box, put it that way.
Okay.
In that, you have 195 vials, little glass vials. In each of those vials, there are five doses. So if you do the maths quickly, that's 975 doses in a 10-inch pizza box. They're shipped in packages of five packs per container. So you would imagine that the minimum supply would be five times that 975. And if I do my maths quickly, I think it's 4875. So something just under 5,000 doses. The other thing you have to think of is that these are dual dose regimens. So if one were planning for a 5,000, and this is a scenario, not an actual fact yet, one would hold back half of those for the second dose just to be absolutely sure that, you know, one was not allowing for the vagaries of supply chain.
So 2,500 people.
Yeah, it's not a bad number to consider if that is the first delivery. Not confirmed yet.
So, margarita with a vax topping, please. But what about the nuts and bolts of getting said pizza boxes delivered?
And these large-scale storage centres and vaccination centres, have all of these premises been booked? Have the conversations been had?
Yes, the conversations are ongoing. I mean, what we decided to do in the implementation plan report. So we brought two documents to government yesterday, a strategy and an implementation plan, and we tried to give as much detail in the implementation plan. So we identified examples of these large-scale hospitals, and we had a very significant, there's a map in the document indicating the geographical distribution. But they're only examples.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these discussions are happening. I mean, Ireland is split into nine what's called CHOs, or community health organisations, but they're really health regions, and so looking at distributions across all of those. And the plan is for the very first phase, Claire, to have used what's called a hub and spoke model. So the hub would be these large-scale facilities. So the vaccines will go from the central storage facility where we have the minus 80 degrees storage of the Pfizer vaccine. Transport them then to these centralized hubs distributed right across the country, and then have mobile units bringing them out to the residential care facilities in a very planned way using specialist vaccinators.
And who are the vaccinators? Where will they be found?
Already there's over 150 of those, for example, that would be based in communities all around Ireland and, for example, that would be responsible for the school vaccination scheme.
Come on the approval and come on the rollout. Now, earlier in the week, you might be forgiven for having had the heart turned crossways in you with the news that a new strain of coronavirus had been detected in the UK. But panic not. Here's Rachel English on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
The existence of this new strain was revealed yesterday as the British government announced that London and some of its surrounding areas will move into the highest tier of restrictions. Martin McKee, Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, joins us now on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
From the information available, and I know that that is pretty sketchy at the moment, is this a significant development, do you think?
It's impossible to say at this stage. First of all, it's important to recognise that this virus does mutate. There's probably about 4,000 mutations that have taken place already, but it mutates at a much slower rate than most other, than many of the other viruses, particularly much slower than influenza virus. The mutation affects one part of the spike protein, which is the bit which binds onto the human cells when it infects people. In terms of what that means, it's difficult to know, because if it mutates to such a degree that it changes the shape considerably, then of course the virus would no longer be able to bind to the human cells and would not be infectious. But on the other hand, there is always a risk that it could change it in such a way that it might not be recognised by the antibodies that are in the vaccine, but that does not seem to be the case. So I think at the present time, most people are thinking that this is probably not that significant, but there is obviously continuing work to be done.
Were you surprised at the way this was announced yesterday?
Very surprised, because it raises fears, it raises concerns, and yet we don't already know, we don't know the answer, we don't know the implications. It shouldn't take too long for us to find out, for example, whether there is any issue with the vaccine, which I think is very unlikely, to be perfectly honest. And it would have been probably better to have waited a few days to have said something rather than create all the concern that we're having at the minute. And yeah, it was a very unusual way to announce a development like this, given that there have been so many other mutations that haven't been announced in this way.
Golly, one might be forgiven for being cynical. Surely not. But if you are looking to the dark art of political spin, here's Anton Savage with a masterclass in how to deflect attention when government projects encounter budget overruns.
Well, the odd thing is, it's actually one of the more easy crises for a minister or for a politician to deal with, because it has all of the things that you want if you're going to preside over a problem. It takes a long time to crystallise. So there's currently an overrun, but we might claw it back, we might not. It'll be years before we know for sure. So you have a very shifting target for a long time. By the time the problem finally does crystallise, the likelihood is that your retired reshuffler in the opposition bench is not your problem to begin with. When it does then finally lay the egg, you have to look and say, who's responsible? That's going to require an inquiry. Good inquiry takes several more years, so time takes on.
And invariably, it's the other guy.
It's always the other guy. Yeah. And the difficulty with when you get involved in multi-million euro projects is the other guy has a lot of lawyers and you can't libel them. So now you have an inquiry that's constrained by issues to do with indemnification, libel, various different strands of responsibility and complex contracts. Takes several years to come out. And when it comes out, therefore, it's unlikely to say, do you know whose fault it was? Frank, he did it. It'll always come out and say, well, it's multifactorial. So if you look at the Edinburgh Parliament, there's a perfect example of it. Lord Fraser did an actually very good report, but it ran to 300 pages and put nobody up against the wall. So at the end of it, everybody sort of went, and moved on. And this is how politicians deal with all good capital overruns. You commission an inquiry, you give it a long time, and you hope that it's lying in somebody else's lap.
That's deeply frustrating for the taxpayer who's
correct.
Paying the bill.
Yes, absolutely.
Ooh, something we all know on a gut level, but to hear it spelt out so clearly, ouch. However, politicians won prizes with Katie Hannan and Co on Late Debate on Thursday night when they doled out the honours and accolades for the year. Categories included Best Orator and Brass Neck, but culminated in the panel's nominees for Politician of the Year.
But I'm going for Simon Harris. I think in the first start of the year as health minister, and I think in the second part of the year in a portfolio that he probably didn't want, he's kind of took off flying, and I think he's probably the most recognisable and the best this year.
Okay, your politician of the year, Simon Harris. Michael.
Catherine Connolly, the independent TD for Galway, for a number of reasons. One is her very balanced non-political contributions in the Dáil. She also was elected as Leas Ceann Comhairle, The first woman, by the way, has never been a woman, that's Count Corla, or Count Corla, so she broke the glass ceiling. Excellent TD.
Okay, Catherine Connolly. Philip Ryan.
I went with three, and that is the...
You can go with three.
It is a three-headed beast. Oh, it is the Coalition of Cerberus. It is the Micheál, Leo and Eamon.
Oh, my God.
It is the three people who got together in the pandemic. And
the Holy Trinity.
The Holy Trinity, there you go.
Okay, very quickly, Harry.
Ono Brenna Sinn Féin, just all-around parity. He's become an expert in his brief, and he's kind of one of the go-to guys in Sinn Féin when they need to come to somebody to come out and explain the party's position, irrespective of what it is.
Okay, and finally, Larry, very quickly.
Sorry, going further afield. Joe Biden, third run for the presidency, 78, down and out after Iowa and New Hampshire, roars back to win the Democratic nomination and defeats the guy who sucked all the oxygen out of politics around the world. He has to be politician of the year.
Okay, this is a big call here, Michael O'Regan, Ono Brin, Joe Biden, Catherine Connolly, the Holy... we didn't get Ono Brin, sorry.
And throw Norma Foley in there as well. Just for
Norma Foley, Simon Harris, or Joe Biden.
I'm going to be very objective here. I think Catherine Connolly narrowly ahead of Ono Brin.
Panel Chair Michael O'Regan calling it on Late Debate on Thursday. Well worth a listen back if you didn't hear it live. Politics has rarely been such fun. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Heading out in the town later? Well, maybe just make sure you look the right way and talk just so. Here's Paul on Wednesday's Live Line. Last Friday, he and his girlfriend and her father went out for a meal.
Book the pub. You know the way now with the COVID, pubs are kind of half restaurant. Book the pub, basically walked up and there was a crowd kind of outside. So me and the half and I were taking some photos outside. So I went in just to get the table and already. So walked up and as your man seen me, he kind of like the way he was walking towards me, I got the impression off him that he didn't like the look of me. So he just said, the table for three booked. And he was like, that's very strange. Hold on there. So he just walked off, came back. He's like, sorry, we actually double booked that table. So you're going to have to leave. And the way he said it to me, rather, you know, sometimes if you double book, you'll say, can you wait at the bar? And we'll get started. Yeah. So I said to him, look, can you not get it sorted there? Like, I can see the table there. Like, obviously, whoever you double booked for, they haven't arrived. So why can't we be put at the table? And he says, look, can you just leave now? And then he said next. So he started talking to the person after me in the line.
Okay.
So I was just kind of standing there, kind of like, you know, kind of in shock, like, Jesus Christ. So I walked out to my other half and our dad, he said, he's at the double booking it. But I don't know, it seems fairly suspicious. But, you know, I didn't, like, my other half dad's over from Brazil. So I didn't want to be making a big scene. So I was standing at the corner at the pub being like, look, we get a taxi because my sister's fella said that they were letting people up into a place where you didn't have to book up in Baggot Street. So standing on the corner and literally a couple walked up, opened the door, but the manager couldn't see me. So I was standing listening. He said, look, is there any chance, I'm probably chancing my arm here, but do you have a table for two? And he's like, yeah, we've a table there. So literally as they walked in, I walked in behind them and you're bringing them to the table with the tree, the tree stool. So I said to the manager, like, what's going on here? And he says, management don't have to give a reason for your refusal. Now, can you leave? And he says, look, you had to tell me it was double booked and your man's had to walk in. And your man had a posh accent. So I was putting two and two together. Do you know, like, what other reason would he be refusing me?
And Paul maintained that this was class discrimination, pure and simple, and not the first time he believed this had happened.
It's happened a lot of times where it's indirect or it's more subtle, but there's been times like growing up in the inner city, like a lot of my friends would be bouncers, like from the inner city, I'd be travellers as well. They work a lot for agencies and they know they can't, they know if they start letting in the local, like the local people from the inner city, that they might get a bad name for them. So the owner of the pub will say to the agency, I don't want your man on the door anymore. So sometimes you're getting refused by people you grew up with.
And why do you think you're treated like that?
It's basically on class. Like that's the whole thing that goes on. Like if you go around
Is it your accent or...?
The accent and then the way, like the way someone say to be middle class would dress up for a night out. Like, I was dressed up, like, I had a jacket and all on, but I had a Fred Perry T-shirt and my accent as well. Like, so that's the stuff that goes on. But even on a subtle level, like, I've gone into pubs with my dad or my friends before, and we literally walk in, not a drink on us, and you're told, on your best behaviour there. Have one point and get out. Do you know, like a middle class person rocking up to a pub, like they won't be getting that said to them. And it's the same if we try book for christenings and all around the IFSC. Like, you put your address, that's it. Or if you ring up, and then you ring up 10 minutes later and give a different address and talk in a different accent, they'd be telling you that you can book that venue.
But some of those inner city areas are also the locations of some mega tech companies. So does the address really matter?
Sheriff Street, then go over the south side of the river and you've Pierce Street and Fenian Street and all. But they're all now home to Google.
The local community that live there, we don't work on any of those jobs. And they go on about diversity and all, but they don't extend their diversity out to employing people in the area. And then the other thing is the gated communities around the IFSC, like, it's not even middle class people living there, it's people that earn an absolute fortune. And a lot of them are empty now. They're either Airbnb or they're people that were earning probably $100,000 or more. Like, and they're living in gated communities. And you see yourself on Sheriff Street, there's a wall that separates us.
Ooh, slippery gentrification. That was Paul on Wednesday's Liveline. Now, have a listen to this.
For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
What a song. Jeff Sherman is the son of Robert Sherman, who, with his brother Richard, composed the music for many Disney musicals, including Mary Poppins. He spoke to Ray on Wednesday.
They were working on Mary Poppins. And usually after school, my father wouldn't get home until dinner time, but he was home and he had the shades closed and he looked really depressed. And I didn't know why. And so what happened was that day they had championed Julie Andrews to become Mary Poppins, got Walt Disney to fly out and see her in Camelot on Broadway. And she came to Los Angeles to hear the songs. And they played all the songs they'd written, and she loved all of them, except for the one that was their favorite song, a song called Through the Eyes of Love. So she went to Walt Disney after their meeting and said, you know, I like everything except that song. It just doesn't feel like Mary Poppins to me. So they told my dad and uncle, and that's why my dad was depressed. It was that day. So I come home from school. I'm a little boy. And my dad looks at me and goes, how is your day? And I said, well, I had the polio vaccine at school, and I was kind of notorious for being that kid. When the nurse would come in with the tray of booster shots, I would tip the tray over, run out of the doctor's office and hide in the neighborhood. So he's surprised I let somebody give me a shot at school. And they had been looking for a phrase like a stitch in time saves nine, something that would be sort of a Mary Poppins philosophy. And I said to my dad, I said, no, it wasn't a shot. They took the sugar cube, dropped the medicine on it, and you just ate it. And my dad stared at me for a long time, went over to the phone, and the next day he went back to the office with my uncle, and they wrote, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
What a brilliant story. What a lovely story. And how many parents all over the world over the last 50-odd years have sung that to their children as they fed the medicine. Yes. Just a spoonful of sugar
helps the medicine go down, and it will be sugar cubes for us all if the vaccine rollout goes according to plan. Because as we limp to see out 2020, is there a certain confusion, nay, bedragglement in the air?
Good morning all, this is Ryan Tubby with you. It is nearly 4 minutes. It is 4 minutes past nine, and it's Thursday morning, and it's still 2020. I mean, there's nothing we can do about that. There's only a few days left, but let's just keep going. And it is definitely the 17th of December 2020 until we're here till 10 o'clock. And I made one of the most schoolboy errors ever this morning, sitting at my desk, and they were talking about festive toilet paper. And I wanted to intervene in the conversation to my colleague and friend for the last 20 years. And I said, Mum, can I ask? I said, oh my God, I can't believe. I know. When was the last time anyone ever did that? at school at the age of seven. I went bright red. I was embarrassed. Everyone was embarrassed for me. I was never more embarrassed for myself. I had just been on the phone to my mother. I mean, that's my excuse. It's, no, you're trying to, you're defending now, aren't you? And I apologised to my colleague. I won't name Siobhan because it wouldn't be fair. But I mean, the point is that she's just minds us all so well. And I just, oh, it's been a long year, hasn't it, everybody? Are we all nodding in agreement? It's been a bonkers year for sure. I want this.
And I can tell you right now, that's not going to be forgiven in a hurry. Meanwhile, over on Lyric on Culture File, it's Scent Week. Yes, sniffing on the radio.
Strong and meaty and funky and complicated, that for a good 15 or 20 seconds, I couldn't get a word out. I was, my brain was just completely focused on figuring out what is this that I just experienced, and is it safe? Is it something that I should maybe be on my guard about?
That is Harold McGee eating grouse for the very first time. And all week long, he was exploring what happens in our bodies and brains when we lean in and sniff, and why smell is intrinsically linked to taste.
We have a half dozen to a dozen different taste sensations, but we have countless odor sensations. And flavor is the combination of taste and smell, texture as well, touch, irritation. The experience of a bite of food or the sip of a beverage is a very, very complicated thing, and taste just doesn't do it justice. The important thing about aroma is that it's what gives us the tremendous variety that we enjoy in flavors. We have about 400 different receptors for smell in the nose. And unlike the receptors for tastes on the tongue, which pretty much report on one particular thing, sweetness or sourness or saltiness, in the case of the odor receptors in the nose, a group of them can participate in one sensation. So when we smell something, we're actually not smelling just one thing. You can think of it as a bit like a chord in music. It's not a single note. It's a chord that gives us an overall impression. And those many different molecules interact with many different receptors in our nose all at the same time. And then that information is channeled to the brain, where the brain puts all those different interactions together into unified perception. Ah, so it's a much more complicated sensation than taste is, and actually still mysterious in many respects. We're still learning a great deal every year about what exactly is going on between the molecule and the perception.
Well, that's very interesting. That was Harold McGee on Culture File. And all of that was a way to prime you for this.
There are so many ways you can cook your Brussels sprouts this Christmas.
And so it begins, the annual attempt to sneak the devil's vegetable onto our plate. And just who does Lucifer employ for his fiendish task?
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, might have bad experience about the Brussels sprout. They're a beautiful vegetable, but it's how you cook them.
Only the most cherubic chef in the land, Boniface Nevin Maguire, he walks amongst us.
So what you do with your Brussels sprouts, Christmas Eve, this is what I'll be doing. I'll have them prepped, and that means cutting them in half. I'll be blanching them in boiling water for about 4 minutes, right, and then I'll put them into cold water. So that refreshes them, keeps the nutrients. They go into the fridge. I'll slice a little bit of onion, a couple of cloves of garlic crushed, and then maybe some smoked bacon. You can have it cooked, you can have it raw, it doesn't really matter. But what I'm going to do is a Brussels sprout crumble. That's definitely richer than the stir fry, but it's delicious.
Could you make soup with Brussels sprouts? Do you think I could make ice cream with Brussels sprouts?
They even smell evil. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Writer Edna O'Brien turned 90 this week, and she took a call with Sean Rocks and Arena to talk about the politics in her work and its humanity.
My books are political. They don't seem so. But what I do, or aim to do, is to take a political situation and make it the backdrop to a human story. So a direct political book, like, say, Fritz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, that's a purely political book. And it's a very good book and a very disturbing book. I'm still very interested, for some reason, in human beings and how and what people do to each other or don't do, in how people behave in difficult situations, in crisis, and so on. And in with both girls, which was about the Boko Haram capturing and of young schoolgirls and submitting them to every known kind of humiliation and trauma. And so taking the human story and giving it its also its political dimension. But the political part is there. It is like the mountain. And the human story is sort of all along. I saw today that Etna erupted. I thought, yeah, that's what writing is. It's an eruption of a kind which has to be, if it's going to be any good or last any length of time, has to have some beauty, the way music has beauty, has to have some, not some, but a lot of that, and of truth, and of human palpability. But the reader will feel, when reading the story, this is a story of real people.
And Sean asked O'Brien about the writing of her groundbreaking 1960 novel, The Country Girls, a novel that shocked as much as it illuminated and enthralled.
In the case of The Country Girls, it was 3 weeks. You sat down at the desk and I think it was a matter of weeks later you had it all written. And
it came. Oh, that was such a lovely feeling. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. 3 weeks it gets me to write the first paragraph. 3 more weeks to write the second one. That is inevitable. I think a first book is like a winged messenger. It comes to one, which is sometimes, not always, but sometimes a little disquieting for an author, because she or he then begins to do the next book and finds that it's not as easy. First book is waiting. The second book, third book, 10th book, 15th book, they have to be dredged out. It doesn't mean they're better or worse. It just means that it's like drawing water from a well. How much more is left in the well?
Well, Girl was your 19th novel. Is there a 20th novel down at the bottom of that well, even if you have to get the bucket down very deep to find it?
Oh, I'm afraid so. There's no other way. And it's not simply by will alone, although it needs very strong will to do it. It's by that mysterious thing called inspiration, which does come.
Edna O'Brien, who turned 90 this week, with Sean on Arena. Now, remember that last week we said Brexit, all eyes on Sunday, can't go past Sunday, no. Yeah, scratch that. It's not over yet. Of course it's not. Because when it comes to Brexit, deadline, schmedline. On Sunday, on the This Week programme, Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney gave this insight into the apparent lack of progress.
We've been speaking to the task force this morning and trying to obviously stay as close as we can to what's happening. The negotiating teams are very, very tight-lipped at the moment in terms of the detail of what they're doing. And that's the way it should be. And by the way, that's a good sign. You know, if you're not hearing from Michel Barnier and you're not hearing from David Frost and their teams in terms of briefings, that is a sign that there is serious discussions ongoing and neither side is breaking confidence. And I would regard that as a good sign. But look, you know, you're going to hear British ministers laying down the law and, making the case that Britain isn't going to compromise anymore and the EU has to come to meet them and all the rest of it. I would ignore a lot of the commentary right now and give the negotiating teams time and space and obviously listen to what the two key principals are saying in terms of the Prime Minister and the Commission President. But, a lot of The rest is noise and commentary that we shouldn't read too much into, I would say.
So no news is good news, maybe. And on Monday, historian Dearmuid Ferriter spoke to Clare about the ongoing relationship between Ireland and the UK, and how the delicate art of diplomacy and statecraft has helped keep both countries from falling out.
Sometimes it's the small little exchanges that reveal much more than the lengthy memoranda. Like the phone call, for example, between Taoiseach Jack Lynch and British Prime Minister Ted Heath on the night of Bloody Sunday in 1972. Reading the transcript of that in the archives, a very emotional Jack Lynch trying to communicate the enormity of what has happened, and Ted Heath is being quite terse and dismissive. And you can see how complicated this is going to be. Mm-hmm. You know,
so
how do you
Ted Heath
that?
Just didn't understand the impact of
it's
that.
It's not understanding the impact or the enormity of it, not being focused enough on it. And this was an enduring theme, and you could say it endures right up to the present day. You know, are they giving this serious matter the attention that it needs in order to prevent escalation? And you also want to avoid what John Peck, the British ambassador in Ireland, described at the time as brawling in public. You know, can we do the work behind the scenes? Can we get dialogue going? Can we open up channels of communication and begin to look at the various strands that are relevant? It's not glamorous work.
Mm-hmm.
It's the work that's going on behind the scenes when you have an intellectual investment by governments and by diplomats in trying to do things that don't involve public confrontation. And again, you can see how that the importance of that theme endures right up to the present about what's going on in private and what's going on in public.
Dearmuid Ferriter on the importance of back-channel negotiation. On Wednesday, we were back with Brexit when Ursula von der Leyen gave this rather cryptic analysis of the state of play.
The path may be very narrow, but it is there. And it is there for our responsibility to continue trying. The good news is that we have found a way forward on most issues. But this is now a case of us being so close and yet being so far away from each other.
Quite poetic, if a little unclear. Thursday evening, dring dring, a phone call was scheduled between Ursula and Boris, prompting Sarah McInerney on Drive Time to ask this of Europe editor Tony Connolly.
Can we expect much to happen out of this? Is this exciting?
Everything is exciting in Brexit land, Sarah, as you know, but this, I think, is simply a stock-taking phone call, seeing where both sides stand as we enter, really, I think, what is the final couple of days of this. I mean, there's been some speculation that we might get an agreement over the weekend, although some people I've spoken to today say it might be more like early next week. But we are, I think, on a pathway towards some kind of agreement. And I think this is just both sides looking at the last obstacles to see what, if any, more political push might be needed. Michel Barnier has said that he doesn't want the treaty to be provisionally applied if it can't be ratified. So that, I suppose, does raise the stakes for both sides to get agreement this weekend. It would be so much neater if they can get an agreement by Sunday. So therefore, the Parliament would say, fair enough, we can ratify this on the 28th of December. But there's every possibility that they simply won't get it over the line this weekend. Yeah. And it could run into next week and see where we are.
Brexit, zut alors. Sunday, maybe. But don't hold us to it. On Monday, Oliver Callan was in for Ryan, and he brought us this.
Rockin' do the strangest things, rockin' do the strangest things, rockin' do the strangest kind of things.
Now here comes the big chorus.
Rockin' Sarah's medicine, rockin' Sarah's medicine, rockin' Sarah's kind of medicine.
Yes, Noah, good morning to you.
Now, the Noah in question is 10-year-old Noah Rafferty. He was on The Toy Show singing that song, and he's just made a recording of it. He is a young man going places, if he can find the right sweets.
Oh my God, I am absolutely chuffed. I didn't believe that I could make it this far, and it's just a dream come true for me.
Well, you deserve every bit of it, and you've been absolutely deadly. I mean, you lifted the roof at the end of The Toy Show. How has your life been since you went back up to Louth, a star made in The Toy Show?
Well, my entire school's been going crazy, and it's just been a wild ride.
Yeah? But you haven't lost the run of yourself, though, have you?
What?
You haven't lost the run of yourself. You haven't gone too mad.
No, I haven't gone too mad. Okay. I have to stay grounded. grounded, John. That's really
totally grounded. You're totally steady because this is very, like, rock is the best medicine, but it's also very serious. It's a serious business. There's no begrudgery, no jealousy at all.
No jealousy. Nothing's going on.
Because you're the young generation. You're different to us old people you see in Ireland. The begrudgery, there's none of that. You're only 10. You've got your head screwed on. You've got a hit song already. I mean, like, you're going to be a star.
Yeah, I know.
By the way, you just have so much confidence. How do you have so much confidence on live telly, again on the radio, recording the tune?
Well, how I stay up so long? Lots and lots and lots of sour worms.
Okay, right. Sour worms. Bags of them.
Cute as a button, that was Noah with Oliver. Well, that is almost it for this week's playback. Ho, ho, hot mayo! Ooh, glitch in the system. Don't know how that slipped in from Ball National School. Anyway, we are not on next week. In fact, we'll be knee-deep in mince pies and tinsel. So a bulging bag of sour worms to all the listeners who got in touch with suggestions for the programme over the year. Very much appreciated. And to the keenest ears in the West, Ms. H, a very special mention. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next year. Feliz Navidad.